the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 119, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And if you want to hear the extended version of this interview, please join the Patreon campaign. You can now get a 7-day free trial where you can access more than 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week, I'm talking to Preston Dennett about his book, Not From Here, Selected UFO Articles, Volume 5. Preston began investigating UFOs and the paranormal in 1986. He is a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network, a ghost hunter, a paranormal researcher, and the author of 30 books and more than 100 articles on UFOs and the paranormal. Hi, Preston. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Yeah, it's a true pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about your book called Not From Here, Selected UFO Articles, Volume 5. You just can't stop publishing books. It's brilliant. One of the things you say at the beginning is that the articles in this book have not been published before?
Correct. All but one of them, actually, which I did kind of increase to about twice its original size. So yeah, these are all completely original, brand new.
Also, you say that most of the chapters in this book have received very little or no attention, these subjects.
Exactly. Yeah, I like to explore avenues of research that haven't been explored before, which isn't always easy, but I love looking for those dark, you know, unilluminated corners of UFO research that people haven't really explored before. And I found a few, so I'm pretty excited about this book. It's doing well. It already hit number one on the Amazon UFO bestseller list, which it is a niche subject, but I'm still pretty happy about it.
There's a load of stuff in there that I hadn't seen before. I've been reading about UFOs for years, maybe decades even. This is really good. Should we start off? I wanted to ask you about this thing of UFO swarms, because we hear about flaps and people might see two or three UFOs. And a flap is, I think, you see one maybe every day, but it goes on for a few weeks or months. So when you say swarms, is it people are seeing hundreds of them?
Exactly. Yeah, and this is, as it turns out, not super common. I started looking into cases like this because I received my own while investigating a wave of sightings over Topanga Canyon. This is in Southern California. And on June 14th, 1992, this was my hometown, actually. I just moved out by coincidence. But yeah, this was my hometown, a little community of then about 8,000, 10,000 people. And on that night, June 14, 1992, bunches of people were seeing UFOs. People were calling the police, the local newspaper office. And most of these people were seeing one or two objects, a few a little bit more, five perhaps. But I found two separate groups of witnesses who saw quite a bit more than that. One saw about 20 or 30. And another, a couple who lived very high up on the ridge. This is a mountain community. They lived in an elevation of about, let's see, I think it's 2,000, 3,000 feet. It overlooks the ocean. It overlooks the canyon towards the mainland. So they had a pretty much 360-degree view of the environment around them. And they saw UFOs rising up from behind one ridge, about 10 of them. This was at 8 o'clock that evening. And they went inside thinking, wow, what the heck was that? When more flashes of light started appearing, and about 20 objects came out. And every 15 minutes or so, another group would rise up from behind the ridge. So they started counting them. And after a period of 2 hours, they counted about 200 objects. Now, this is insane when you think about it, because looking for other cases like this, I really found none initially. It took quite a bit of research, but I did find some other cases involving hundreds of objects. So yeah, these are UFO swarms. super fleets, I guess you might call them, but they're exceedingly rare. I mean, there's just not a whole lot of cases of these.
And I was interested in the 1950 one in Farmington. It seems like there were a lot of witnesses there.
Yeah, I think this is the ultimate case of this kind. March 17, 1950, Farmington, New Mexico. It's a little town in North New Mexico. It had a population of about 3,000, 4,000, but you know, in the surrounding areas, up to 6,000. It was on 10 a.m. around that time when people were drawn outside. You know, traffic stopped in the streets. People ran out of their businesses because there were several hundred of these saucer-shaped objects, which were putting on what UFO researchers call a display. You know, normally they're quite evasive. They'll perhaps swoop down, show themselves, pick someone up maybe, and off they go. But no, they stayed there and they put on a display that lasted at least 2 hours. So more than 1,000 people saw this, probably a lot more. They're estimating at least half the town. But they were performing all these fantastic loops and accelerations and decelerations and turning at right angles and flying in patterns. It was just really dramatic. And the witnesses are not, you know, just the citizens, your average Joe. I mean, there was the newspaper staff, there were pilots, police, of course, the mayor of the town. So there was no way of covering this up. And this immediately got into newspapers and caused quite a controversy as the Air Force tried to debunk it in various ways, saying, I think one explanation was that a skyhook balloon had shattered and into a million little pieces and was just fluttering down across the sky, which makes no sense because the pieces would have hit the ground and they didn't. And furthermore, these things were scooting across the sky. Some people had a close-up view because it sometimes dived pretty low. And you could see metallic craft. Some were glowing red, others white. Some appear to be coming out of other objects. So there was a lot going on. And in fact, there was two separate waves on that day. They kind of left after a little bit and then came back again. So they're estimating at least 85% of the town's population of about, you know, 6,000 people saw this. Crazy when you think about it.
And did you find any photos? I suppose in the 50s, it wasn't like everybody had a camera.
Yeah, it turns out there's a very famous photo which was taken. And that in itself is really unusual because when you consider how many people have reported encounters, I mean, we're approaching close to a million documented cases, honestly. And the number of photos are nowhere near that. So it's very, very rare that someone is able to capture any photographic evidence. So in this case, you would think that somebody would, and of course they did. And it's a, you know, it's not a super conclusive, you know, outstanding photo. I'm not sure how skeptics would feel about it. But when you add to it all this eyewitness testimony, it's a pretty impressive photo, which shows these kind of disc-shaped dark objects, a group of them up in the sky. So yeah, it's an old photo and you can kind of tell. But it's such an amazing incident because what are they doing? You know, why are there so many of these objects? There was some speculation, and I don't know what to think of this, but there was a very famous UFO crash not far from that area, Aztec, New Mexico. And according to some reports, now the date of that crash is disputed, but some report that it was on that actual day, I think 2 years earlier or so. So some were thinking, well, maybe it's a display commemorating the anniversary of that UFO crash, which I thought was kind of an interesting speculation. Of course, no way to prove it, but you have to wonder because there just aren't a whole lot of cases where so many people see these objects. Or, I mean, there are so many objects, rather.
Like you said, there was some debunking going on, but I think in the book you said there was an editorial that was called Give Us the Facts. And I like it because they said at least half believe what they saw was an armada of spaceships. And the American population is not composed chiefly of children or idiots. And it's almost like that's what you want to say to the Pentagon today. And this Farmington thing happened 70 years ago.
Exactly, which makes it such a joke. And the statements coming out of our governments are completely disingenuous when they say we have no good reporting on UFOs being real. We don't have any evidence. We're still investigating. We've just started investigating. I mean, everything they say, it's absurd. For them, I mean, it just raises my hackles, and I get so angry when I think about how much they're lying and how much they're covering up and how different it could be if there was just truth and transparency on this subject. Because the evidence is there. There are enough cases to conclusively prove the validity of the presence of UFOs and ETs. But we're just not getting that from our own governments.
And also, if you say, you ask an astronomer about it, they'll just say, well, we have no evidence that there's life anywhere but Earth. But in your book, you've got a chapter about astronomers who've seen UFOs.
Exactly. And I really wanted to put that out there because there is a misconception that only uneducated people see UFOs. And that's just not true. I mean, we've got hundreds of pilot encounters, people from all levels of military, very high ranks in the military have seen UFOs, and actually a pretty long and impressive list of high-profile, famous, very well-educated astronomers who have seen UFOs. So I think it's important that people realize this. This is really good evidence to sort of, dispel the myth and provide ammunition for skeptics or for, you know, anyone, for researchers to disprove skeptics and their assertions that astronomers don't see UFOs, because they do.
In the book, you've got sightings by astronomers going back hundreds of years.
Yeah, I mean, Edmund Halley, I think he's probably the most famous astronomer out there, the discoverer of Halley's Comet. He's describing seeing UFOs way back in the 1600s. And he saw at least a couple of UFOs. And of course, William Herschel, also very famous. He was credited with the discovery of the planet Uranus. And he saw some very interesting unexplained lights on the moon, on the lunar surface, and more than just once, a number of times, and also described seeing all kinds of objects as little disc-like objects and spherical objects moving through our atmosphere that he couldn't explain. But it goes all the way up to, you know, modern times. In 1930, Clyde Tombaugh got a lot of publicity and kind of became a legend when he discovered the planet Pluto and got a lot of publicity for it. But 19 years later, on August 20, 1949, he and his whole family actually saw this craft with little portholes and metallic craft scooting across the sky at night, 10:45 p.m., and went public with it and didn't get any publicity really at all. Kind of turned him into a UFO advocate. He would speak very vocally about it, trying to get mainstream scientists and astronomers to talk about UFOs and at least consider them, but didn't have a whole lot of luck with it. It's really unfortunate because more and more astronomers continued to see UFOs and had a real hard time getting people to take it seriously, including J. Allen Hynek, who, as I'm sure you know, is the father of modern ufology and the astronomical consultant for Project Blue Book. So people need to know that there are a lot of astronomers who have seen UFOs. Probably my favorite is astronomer Frank Halstead. He was the director of the Darling Observatory in Duluth, Minnesota. And on November 1st, 1955, he was on a train traveling through Death Valley with his wife, and they saw two UFOs very close up, hovering over this mountain range nearby, metallic, quite large. One was about 800 feet, he estimated. The other 200 feet. One looked more kind of lamp-shaped, but the other was definitely a disc. And absolutely convinced him that UFOs are real. And he was also very vocal about it. So I don't know where this misconception comes from that astronomers haven't seen UFOs, because they have, including Jacques Vallée, who is a huge figure in this field.
They have this thing in the UK where they have like a daytime TV show and somebody comes on who's a UFO author or some kind of expert. They always get like somebody else to give a balanced view, and for some reason it's always an astronomer. But it seems to me that getting an astronomer in, if they're not somebody who reads a lot of books about UFOs, they're not really going to give a balanced view. They don't really know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's just a pretext to calling it a balanced view. And really, it's a debunking effort. So what other field of study do they bring in someone else who says, no, none of this is happening? You're wrong. It's your providing is not credible. I mean, it's absurd. If you're going to talk about a subject, you should definitely be educated on it.
And so in the book, you also talk about White Sands employees who saw an object. And they did some triangulation measurements on it, and it was moving really fast.
Yes, I love that case because, you know, White Sands is kind of, gosh, a magnet for UFO activity. There's a lot of nuclear research going on there, a lot of rocketry. And if you look into the history of White Sands, there are an enormous number of encounters there. But in 1954, an astronomer by the name of Shaldak, he was worked at Lowell Observatory. He was monitoring a missile launch. And let's see, this was on January 25, 1954. And he's calibrating his cameras and his instruments when he notices a yellow-white light moving across the sky, pulsating. He can immediately tell this is not a meteor of any kind. And little does he know, there is another witness about 12 miles away, also watching this object. And when they got together and compared their reports, they were able to triangulate. Because if you have another witness in another location, that can allows you to sort of do some math and determine the size and speed and altitude of an object. And they estimated this object was moving at about 12,000 miles per hour. Now, what's so interesting about this case and really telling is they did report it to Project Blue Book, who handled all the UFO reports at that time for the Air Force. And although these astronomers are trained observers and they know the sky and they told them it's not a meteor, Blue Book officers really did no investigation whatsoever and concluded that what the astronomers had seen was, in fact, a meteor. Which is so unbelievable, because he said in his report, and I quote, "I've observed many thousands of meteors and can definitely state that this object was not any kind of meteor."
Meteors burn up in the atmosphere anyway. They would have said they saw a ball of fire rather than an object.
Exactly. Meteors don't really pulsate in a regular fashion. I mean, they might flare up, but not in a pulsating up and down in brightness. So that's just really good evidence in my mind of the government cover-up from a very early time. It's such a shame. And Dr. Peter Sturrock, he's a professor of physics at Stanford University. He actually sent out about 2,600 questionnaires to all the members of the American Astronomical Society. And he received over 1,000 responses, and 62 were from professional astronomers who said that they had actually observed UFOs but most of them remained silent in fear of damaging their credibility among their colleagues. And he even got answers from other people saying, if I even saw one, I wouldn't report it. So, I mean, how do you even deal with that? If someone, a professional scientist is refusing to come forward with their own observations. Because according to Jacques Vallée, he was at an astronomy, you know, an astronomical observatory when UFOs were caught and recorded, and they destroyed the evidence in front of his eyes. That's what got him involved in the UFO subject. So I don't know how we expect to have any scientific progress if we're destroying evidence and withholding evidence.
Yeah, I kind of think that the great scientific discoveries coming up when there are anomalies and you look into the anomaly and think, hang on a second, this is showing our theories aren't correct. We need to update our ideas on this stuff.
We really need to have truth and I mean, there's no two ways about it. It's time to stop this cover-up. It's just not tenable. Yeah. I think that's why we're having steps towards disclosures, because the government who are covering this up have reached a point of not being believable in their denials of this, you know, the validity of the UFO subject.
Another subject in the book, which is really interesting, is aliens at UFO conferences.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to do a deeper dive in this because I was present at the Triad UFO conference in San Diego in 1994, when a number of people claimed to have had an encounter at various hotel rooms on the night before the conference. Now, I was staying at a friend's house. I didn't have an encounter, but I know some people who did. And the fact that, you know, I ended up actually writing a book about some of this, the Coronado Island UFO incident. And I interviewed several of the witnesses. Yvonne Smith also wrote a book about this particular case. But it was just a remarkable thing when you think about this case of, you know, people being taken on board a craft and having this massive encounter with multiple people on one night on Coronado Island, which, if you know that location, it's densely populated. It's a tourist trap. It's got a very strong police force. It's actually partly owned by the Navy. This is where the Navy SEALs do their training. It's the least likely place you can imagine for an encounter. And it was years later, I was doing another conference in Irvine, Southern California. I was talking about USOs, unidentified submersible objects. And it went really well. I had a great time and left the conference and later found out that someone said he had an encounter in his hotel room where he was actually healed of a torn Achilles tendon. And he's a great witness, Michael Knox. He became very vocal about his encounter. He had another witness with him in the hotel room. The fact that his Achilles tendon was healed is good evidence. And turned out there was another report from someone outside the hotel who had seen UFOs hovering on that evening. And there was a third witness who reported her experience to, I think it was the National UFO Reporting Center, where she said she was taken on board from her hotel room, again, at the same location, same night. And she says she saw people from the conference on board the craft, including several of the presenters. I was one of the presenters. No, she didn't name them. But I thought, wow, you know, because I woke up that morning feeling strangely ill for no good reason, a little bit nauseous and just out of sorts. And I kind of always wondered about that. So that's what got me interested. And I decided to take a deeper look. And I found a contactee who said that she was at a conference when she swears up and down, people were telling her that this really tall, very ET-looking figure was walking among the crowds. And, that's, of course, hearsay. She didn't see it herself. But it was certainly interesting. Janet Lesson is her name. I know who she is. She's, you know, a very intelligent and sincere person. I don't see her as being someone who does wild speculations. But I really wondered about it because there was another guy who wrote a book about an incident at another conference where a bunch of people saw apparently these blue-skinned beings. I did talk to a witness there. She says she saw them. She wasn't convinced they were ET, but did admit that they were somewhat unusual looking. So I don't know. I think the most interesting case I found was a rash of sightings that occurred during the Contact in the Desert conference. This was in 2016, June 4th. And there's at least 20 or 30 people who stepped forward with their accounts of seeing these glowing objects swooping down, putting on again a display, clearly wanting to be seen. These were filmed. They were viewed through binoculars, night vision binoculars. A lot of people saw these. So I have to think this was an intentional display. And what better place to show up than at a conference where all these people who are there, who are either contactees or already very much interested in the UFO phenomenon. So yeah, this is apparently a thing. I didn't find as many cases as I hoped I would find, but I think there's enough to, you know, merit a closer look.
I suppose for ETs, if they want to pick up some abductees that they're working on, finding them all together in one place makes it an easy night.
Right? Well, I mean, there's some indication of that. There was another case where a lady was at a conference and some people reported a UFO. I think it was, gosh, I'd have to look up where this was. I think Canada or the northwest of US, Washington. At any rate, she also saw these UFOs and woke up the next morning with what she believes was an implant, started having encounters after this. So yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a possibility. I don't know. But as anyone who researches this subject knows, an encounter can happen anywhere. I've got several which have taken place in hotels and condominium complexes and very urban areas with lots of, you know, densely populated areas.
So if we can move on and talk about one of the other chapters, the twin connection. And what I find interesting is something that you mention is that twins are kind of like natural clones. And the ETs might be interested in them because of that, because this whole hybrid thing.
Yeah, I wonder about this. What I did find was, in my own research, what appeared to be a pretty high incidence of twins among the contactee population. I'd interviewed quite a few people who were like, well, you know, I'm a twin. Like, oh, well, that's interesting. And when that first happened, I ended up interviewing both twin brothers, fraternal twins, who had both had encounters. One with praying mantis type beings, and the other with grays. Both were very benevolent encounters, and one was quite extensive, the other fairly brief. But I started thinking because there was another case I had researched involving a lady who was pregnant with twins and had lost one in utero mysteriously. It really baffled the doctors. She found out her medical records were being sent to some government lab without her permission. A nurse told her this. She says, don't tell anyone. I could lose my job if I felt you should know this. And the doctors told her that her chances of carrying this pregnancy were about 1 in 5 million. So they watched her very closely. And her surviving twin was born healthy, but very psychic, a very intuitive young child. And he kept talking about seeing angels in his room. Eventually he pronounced it right. It was angels. And he kept talking about his brother, who he didn't even know he was a twin. So he was apparently still in contact, whether it's spiritually or, you know, ET-wise, it's hard to say. But this is what got me start to think about twins. This is when I realized, well, gosh, you know, the Allagash case in Maine, investigated by Raymond Fowler, involved the twins. I forget their names, the Jack and Doug? Jim. Jack and Jim Wiener. both identical twins. And they said when they were taken on board, the ETs seemed very much interested in this fact. And we do know the ETs do seem to show a very strong interest in human genetics, genetics in general. So perhaps that's what's going on here. But quite a few twins in the contactee population. And I found this super interesting because when people describe seeing ETs, often they will say things like, you know, they looked almost identical. They could have been twins. This is true with grays, but more often with human-looking ETs. When someone sees more than one, they'll say, well, you know, I saw two or three of these human-looking ETs and they looked like twins to me. So I wonder if there's, you know, an aspect there that's connected somehow. But yeah, there definitely seems to be a connection here.
Yeah, and you've got, I think there's a guy called Buddy who says when he was 16, he was introduced to his clone and that he had to train his clone in how he behaves and how he thinks.
Yeah, I remember this case. This is from, if I recall, Artie Six Killer Clark. I like her research because she's very objective. She's not pushing a fear narrative. She's just telling it as it is. I think this case was from Belize. And this witness, Buddy, had seen a number of UFOs and was taken on board. And at one point was shown someone who looked just like him. Now, I'm guessing he just assumed this was a clone when perhaps it was just a twin, because we do have this missing fetus syndrome. And I've got a lot of cases of this where a contactee their mother was pregnant with twins, and one of the twins disappears. I mean, I wrote a book, Symmetry, about contactee Dolly Safran. And her mother was pregnant with twins, but only one was born, Dolly. And she later met her twin on board a craft. So I think this is what's going on in this case from Artie Six Killer Clark, not necessarily a clone, because clones, I don't know, we have, certainly here on Earth, we have not been able to produce clones that are really viable. There's problems with them. They don't live long. So in either case, it's so interesting because in that particular instance from Artie Six Killer Clark, they switched places for like, I think it was 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And yeah, the alleged ET twin went down and kind of learned what it's like to be on Earth for a little while.
And it makes you wonder where they are now. If there's a society on a planet somewhere that's just like full of humans, maybe a million of them, and they're just as human as we are. They just live on another planet.
Oh, I'm sure there are, because ETs have been collecting genetic material from us for a very long time. And they certainly have the ability to produce humans. And if you look at the contactee reports, there's many, many cases. I mean, that's probably... You know, I always say it's, you know, I mostly get grays, which I do, but it's increasingly more reports of just your plain old human looking people. So it wouldn't surprise me one bit if there are other planets out there populated with humans. Well, you know, Dolly Safran talked about that. She was taken to a planet where the population there looked very much like us, Polynesian. And there were slight differences in, you know, the teeth and the hair and, you know, the skin texture and the eyes and things like that, but could walk on Earth absolutely and not be recognized for anyone other than human.
There's a sentence that I copied out of the book. It says, this woman, she said, I was pregnant with twins in 1995. And after about 5 months, I woke up one morning and one of the babies was gone. And she could see it on her stomach, how it had decreased in size. And she stood on the scales and she weighed 7 pounds less.
Yes, exactly. So this is a really good example of the vanishing twin or missing fetus syndrome. There are a lot of cases of this, and doctors are at a loss to explain a lot of them. They use explanations like, well, you know, it was absorbed. Now, the whole twin phenomena is still not fully understood. It's actually a lot more common that people, you know, a woman is actually pregnant with twins, and then one vanishes very early on in gestation. And it's always been assumed that it's being absorbed, and that is the accepted explanation, and is probably true in a lot of these cases. But it's not at all understood exactly how this happens. So there could be a lot more going on here that we don't fully understand, and it could be connected to, you know, this ET phenomena. There's so many cases of twins in the contactee population. It deserves a closer look, and I couldn't find any research out there on this, really. So this chapter was pretty much first real study, I think, that certainly I was able to find, where people look, you know, where we took a look at this. So I'm hoping there's more research on this.
Because we hear people, women report sometimes that they have false, they call them false pregnancies, don't they? That the doctors maybe confirm it, and after 3 months, the baby just disappears. And these women are having these abduction experiences, this thing where the ETs are impregnating her, and it seems like they need the human womb for 3 months, and then they can take the fetus and it'll develop somewhere else.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, we here on this planet are suffering terrible genetic damage for a lot of reasons: the weakening of our magnetic field, pollution, drugs, all kinds of things are really taxing our genetics. And from what I've been able to find out from interviewing contactees and doing the research I do, is that this is one of the primary reasons people are taken on board. It's about healing. It's about upholding our genetics. And I find it super fascinating. I mean, there was a case from Florida involving a gentleman who actually asked the ETs, "Why are you taking me?" And they told him, "We are interested in your genetic potential to live a long time," which really rang a bell with him, because he has longevity in his family. His grandfather was 106. His aunts had lived past their, you know, the year 100. So this just goes to speak about, you know, how ETs, one of their missions is healing. And I have to wonder about that, because statistically, we know that humanity, the longevity has increased, almost doubled over the past 200-300 years, from about age 40 to 80. So perhaps there was some intervention going on there. Because I can't tell you how many contactees I've talked to who've gone to the doctor and said, "You know, you have the lungs of an 18-year-old, or you're in fantastic health." They enjoy really good health and longevity in a lot of cases. That's not always the case, but definitely it turns up.
Another chapter is calling all UFOs, and you've got some experience of this, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. This fascinated me because one of my early cases that I investigated came from a friend of my father's. He worked in the movie business, my dad did. He's like, "I've got a guy you should interview. He says he saw a UFO." His name was Arnie Weiler, and he worked as a set dresser and a set designer for NBC, and described this experience where he had gone onto the lawn of the George Page Museum at the La Brea Tar Pits. This is in Santa Monica, California, where they were setting up lights in the shape of a peacock's tail for the NBC emblem. And they used these computerized lights called pixel lights, which are quite large, brilliant, multicolored. And they set them up in the shape of sort of a half disc, like a peacock's tail, turned them on, and no sooner did they turn them on than three UFOs came swooping down as if to take a look at it. And he turns to the guy who actually, you know, worked to set all up this equipment. He was a special effects expert. Rick Liebert was his name. And Rick's like, "Oh yeah, you know, this happens quite a bit. When I do these special effects, when I set up these lights, UFOs will show up." So of course, I ended up calling Rick Liebert, and he verified that encounter and told me another, which occurred in San Diego, where he had set up a green argon laser, a spectrophysics laser, on top of what was then the tallest building in San Diego, a bank building. And the whole idea was a publicity stunt to flash this laser in beat to the rock music. It was for a radio station. So Pink Floyd and, you know, other rock music. And they turned this laser on and it started flashing in beat to the music. And very quickly, two UFOs showed up, which were boomerang shaped, came right down over the building, clearly in response to this laser. So it was a publicity stunt, and it got a lot of publicity, but I don't think it got the kind they were expecting. So these were the two cases that really intrigued me. And I ended up writing an article for UFO Universe magazine about this case and a few others like it. And this really caught fire. And it turns out that Stephen Greer, a very well-known researcher in this field and experiencer, read that article. And he later told me, he's like, that article lit a fire under me to start CSETI. This is a group he formed, the Center for Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which uses lights and meditation to basically call down UFOs. It's funny because he came to LA, where I lived at that time. This was around 1992, I believe he showed up, 94, and gave a lecture and talked about, you know, here's how you can call down UFOs. And imagine my shock when he started quoting my cases. Like, wow, that's me. So that was really cool. But yeah, we ended up going out, a small group of us. I would say there was 50 people or so, 100 people who attended that lecture. And a much smaller minority of us went out into the, not the wilderness so much, but a somewhat remote location outside of LA to hopefully see and call down UFOs. And I was so surprised because no sooner had we showed up, there must have been 40 of us there, 30 or 40. It was very cold, late at night. And someone shouts out, look, look up. And of course, we all looked up and there was this object. Now, it was way the heck up there. I would estimate anywhere from 10,000 to 40,000 feet. But it was a large glowing object. I would say about a quarter to half the size of a full moon, very irregular in shape. But I could tell instantly this was not a helicopter, plane, satellite, shooting star, balloon. And it just sort of faded away very quickly. We saw it for about 3 or 5 seconds. But I knew enough about astronomy at that point. You know, I was doing my studying that wasn't anything we could explain easily. But yeah, I think this method works. I became a part of that group CSETI. And over the next 5 years or so, we would go out once every couple of months and do our meditation and flash lights at the sky. And we ended up having some really dramatic sightings.
And so do you feel that with the meditation, it was almost like there's some kind of ESP or telepathy or something, as well as flashing lights, because we know ETs seem to communicate with telepathy. Maybe that's an essential part of the connection to cool them down.
Yeah, I think it's actually the key. Lights might help to some extent if you want to like flash a light and they'll flash back, because we did have that on a number of occasions. But ultimately, I think it is reaching out mentally, telepathically, that is the most effective tool. And there's been a number of cases where that really showed up. I remember once I was in Topanga Canyon. We were doing one of our little CSETI outings to try to call down UFOs. And we were in the middle of the meditation, which by synchronicity or whatever, I was leading the meditation for the first time, which I don't really like to do. I prefer to stay in the sidelines. But they're like, it's your turn. I'm like, okay, I'll do it. So I organized the whole thing, you know, the location and got everyone together and made sure, you know, we always need someone to organize an outing. And it was my turn, so I did it. But we were in the middle of the meditation, and I got this very strong impulse to just look up. And I kept thinking, no, I'm not doing that. I'm meditating with my eyes closed, you know, trying to calm them down. Finally, I just couldn't take it anymore. So I had this feeling that they were up there. And no sooner did I look up when a dot of light appeared straight up at the zenith and expanded in size to this unbelievable size covering. And I hate to say it because it sounds ridiculous, but almost a third of the sky, this enormous flash of milky white light. And I admit it was very quick. I mean, I didn't even have time to really call out and alert the other people there. And I felt kind of foolish when I told them after the meditation, well, you're not going to believe what I just saw, because you know, I didn't get a chance to tell them. But I did later, a couple of weeks later, get verification when I located another couple who was driving through the canyon about a mile away from where I was. And at the same exact time, they saw a craft close up right near their car, metallic, covered with lights. That wasn't what I saw. I have to think I saw something either coming or going. But it was definitely a level of corroboration there for me in terms of unusual activity in the area at that time.
And again, I'll go on to another chapter I wanted to talk about, but I just want to say there's a lot more chapters in the book than we're going to talk about. So there's a lot more information there. But this one of you've called You Have Been Warned, where there's this thing where people have been abducted who are sat down almost like the ETs sit them in front of a TV and just show them videos of terrible destruction on the planet.
Yes, yes. And I've been receiving so many requests to do more research on this from, you know, people who read my books or hear me on podcasts like yours. I'm like, talk about this. And I've always kind of resisted it because each time I try to do research on it, it's a monumental task. Because I have to tell you, when someone receives any communication from ETs beyond, don't be afraid, you're fine, we won't harm you, no harm will come to you, this sort of thing, it's along these lines of warnings and prophecies even. So it's very, very common. So finally, I just said, you know what, I'm going to do some research on this. And sure enough, this ended up being a really difficult project because there are so, so many cases of this. This ended up being by far the longest chapter in the book. So I profiled, I'm not sure how many, about 30 or 40 cases. And a lot of the major researchers to see what they had to say about this. And pretty much all of them have received cases like this. And in case after case, ETs are warning primarily about the dangers of nuclear proliferation or the use of nuclear materials, really in any capacity. But it goes so much beyond that. I mean, there was one lady I interviewed from Maine. She was taken on board. She met her full-grown hybrid son, and he had a long list of warnings for her. He told her, you need to tell people to stop putting out the greed and negativity that you're putting out because this is having a bad effect and you're going to destroy your society, your world, like we did. He told her that there was probably going to be an earthquake going down the central United States, the Madrid Fault, I believe it's called, upcoming at some point in our future. Told her that Hurricane Katrina, which had just occurred at that time, was nothing compared to what would be coming up in the future, which turned out to be true. We've had a lot of hurricanes here striking the United States of unbelievable ferocity. So this is the kind of warnings people are getting. There was another case, Walter Rizzi, an Italian contactee, who I think had his experience back in the, I remember, 50s or so. But the ETs told him that at some point there's going to be a pole flip. Basically, our planet is going to rock right over. I found that interesting because that turns up in a number of these cases. But yeah, ETs will show people vivid imagery. Some people remember this in the form of dreams or sort of telepathic visions. But one guy I interviewed, Kevin Kamen, he's a twin, by the way, was taken on board. And they told him that since we started exploding nuclear bombs, all these future disasters would happen. He said it was like looking out of a window at them, full 3D, absolutely real looking. And they showed him hurricanes and tornadoes and mudslides and all kinds of weather phenomena, mostly earthquakes as well. And they said, all this will happen. You've started a countdown clock. You can't stop it, but you need to, you can mitigate it by absolutely ending all nuclear testing. And case after case, ETs have said it's nuclear that concerns them most, because apparently we're harming areas of the planet. And not only that, but beyond that, other dimensions that we're not even aware of. And this is, these are having very long-term effects in ways that we don't even understand. But so many cases of this, just one after. I could have written a whole book on just this. But I really wanted to, I might still. But I felt like time was of the essence, because everything the ETs have been telling people about is actually happening. We're seeing it right now. So this, I think, is one of the most important chapters in the book. And it's something we really need to take seriously when people are getting these messages. Some researchers have likened them to fear tactics, saying, oh, they're just trying to scare us and make us change our ways. Others feel, no, these are absolute predictions that will take place. Others feel that perhaps the ETs are just studying a person's reactions when they show them these things. I think that's a little bit of a cop-out, because I can tell you that most of the contactees who have experienced this believe them to be valid predictions or warnings, certainly. So yeah, I think this is one of the reasons why contact escalated to unbelievable levels at the dawn, coinciding exactly with the age of modern UFOs, 1947. Because before that, we weren't getting onboard experiences in any large numbers like we are now since then. And that's exactly when we started exploding nuclear weapons. That's exactly when we started polluting our planet to the point of no return. So we're basically, this is what the ETs are saying, we're facing an existential crisis. And we have to change our ways or we're done for.
Well, we've been talking about your book. It's called Not From Here, Selected UFO Articles, Volume 5. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
They can, or other online retailers. You can check out my website if you want to read an excerpt. Just punch my name in. It should take you there. But yeah, I love exploring these unusual avenues and unexplored areas. So I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Do you have another book in the works? Can you tell us what it will be about?
Oh, I'm always working on something. Probably my next project is going to be Symmetry, Volume 2. I don't have a working title yet, but it's going to continue the story of Dolly Safran and the book Symmetry, A True UFO Adventure, because we really only scratched the surface of what she's experienced. But I'm working on another book on out-of-body experiences. I've got a lot of stuff I want to put out still, so I'm working hard.
Great. Thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that was an interview with Preston Dennett about his book, Not From Here, Selected UFO Articles, Volume 5. And a great way to support this podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFO podcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Our Paranormal Afterlife. And there are over 300 episodes. My website is pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression, and I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is ourparanormalafterlife with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. Isn't there a thing that some abductees say they've had training on flying the craft, and it's almost like the ETs are saying to them, you'll have a mission to do and you'll know what to do when the time comes?
100%. Yeah, that was basically the theme of my book Symmetry with Dolly Safran. She was trained by them to pilot the craft. And it was shortly after I published that book.